Welcome back to the High Functioning Disaster, the show where we stop pretending life is neat and instead talk honestly about what it takes to hold it all together when life feels like it's falling apart. I'm your host, Sasha Holder. Today I'm joined by Angie Hawkins, author of Running in Slippers and a coach who helps women break free from people-pleasing, perfectionism, and self-abandonment. Angie's story is raw, real, and powerful. From growing up with emotionally unavailable parents to hitting rock bottom during the COVID pandemic, to the moment a friend's words, "It's not your time," set her on the path to healing. We're diving into how limiting beliefs shape our lives, why vulnerability is more connecting than shameful, and what radical self-love looks like when it's messy, imperfect, and real. This is one of those conversations that reminds you, even in the darkest seasons, hope is possible, and you're never as alone as you feel. All right. Welcome, Angie. I'm so glad to have you on the High Functioning Disaster. How are you today?
I'm good. How are you, Sasha? Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. I'm doing pretty well. I'm a bit jealous that you're in Hawaii, where it's perpetually nice. I mean, I'm sure you have rainy season, but way nicer than the Midwest.
Yes. I mean, even the rainy season, it just rains for like 10 minutes and then it's fine. If it rains all day long, I actually, and you, just so everyone else knows, because you know this, I actually grew up in Indiana. Then I lived in Chicago for a long time. So I'm originally from the Midwest, where it rains, it snows, it's cloudy a lot. But here, if it's rainy, like an entire day, or cloudy an entire day, I get really pissed off. Like, why is the weather so bad?
Right. I think I would too.
Yeah. So I definitely am spoiled by the weather.
Yeah. So can you, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give just like your like 1 minute, 90 second sort of elevator pitch of your story, like who you are?
Ooh, 1 minute, 90 seconds. Okay. So I grew up in basically the way I describe it, my parents were emotionally unavailable. There were a lot of other dynamics, but it's hard for me to describe because I don't want to speak ill of my parents because I understand. Can you hear that siren? I feel like the noises come up at the worst times. Because I'm not trying to speak ill of my parents. I understand why they were the way they were. And that's just it. As an adult, I have that understanding. But as a child, I didn't understand what was going on. I didn't understand why they were the way they were. So I developed a belief that I didn't deserve to be loved. And that belief haunted me my entire life until recently. And your beliefs dictate your behaviors, and then your behaviors dictate what you bring into your life. So I struggled for a really long time because I was a people pleaser. I call it dysfunctional overachieving because I do think there are healthy ways to achieve and grow, but there are definitely dysfunctional ways to do that, which I did all the things. And I was really miserable for a really long time. And unfortunately, I had to hit rock bottom for me to decide that I wanted to change.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that happens to most of us. We have to hit that rock bottom. And so your memoir, Running in Slippers, it talks about your journey and your rock bottom. So what do you remember most vividly about that moment, the breaking point?
What I remember the most is, because I had this like 2.5 year period of like thing after thing after thing. And it started when my boyfriend broke up with me and my dad died. And that's actually how the book starts. And it was just thing after thing after thing, which I admittedly was contributing to the situations because of how my limiting beliefs and how I was behaving and acting in the world. However, you know, I think we all have moments in our lives where things are piling up and we think to ourselves, I can't take this anymore. And I was definitely feeling that way. But the overarching way of, you know, feeling that I was having was I just felt total hopelessness because I had been living my way life a certain way for such a long time, and it didn't feel like anything was going right. And I just had this moment of like, I don't see a better future. And that's such a dangerous place to be, because when you lose all hope, you lose everything. And I can definitely attest to that.
Yeah. And that's really powerful. A lot of people get to that point where they feel like, you know, they're just done with everything.
Yeah. And one of the reasons I share my story, well, one reason is because I feel like a lot of people go, you know, life is hard. We all go through hard things and we're just not talking about it. So I share my story because it's like, I was a high-functioning disaster for many years, and I'm not afraid to talk about it to let other people know they're not alone. But also to let, if people are in that place of hopelessness, there is hope for the future. And trust me, I get it when you're in that emotional pain in the moment and you can't see past it, but there's always hope for the future. Trust me, like if I can turn my life around, anyone can.
Yeah, and that really... You hit on the head. The point of this podcast is, you know, we all are in a disastrous situation, or our lives feel like a disaster and it's too much. We don't know how to cope.
Yeah. Well, especially when you're trying to put on that facade of like everything's okay and you want to seem like you have it all together, and behind the scenes, everything's falling apart.
Exactly. Exactly. So looking back, what was the very first step you took that made you think, okay, I'm still here and something has to change? Like, can you pinpoint one thing, or maybe it's a couple of things?
No, it was definitely one thing, because what happened was when I decided I had enough, I intentionally overdosed on my anxiety medication and I spent a day and a half unconscious in my bathroom. I was blacked out, but I somehow managed to text a friend, and my friend took me to the hospital, and I spent another day and a half in the hospital. So I was out of commission for 3 entire days. And when the hospital released me, it was during COVID. So like all my personal belongings were in plastic bags, and they were like, you can't open these till you get outside. And I had no ride home. So I'm just standing on the curb with my plastic bags, like, now what? So I open up my phone to order an Uber to get home. And I had a bunch of texts because, again, my phone was off for 3 days, or I wasn't responding to it in 3 days. And I was supposed to go to a workshop that my friend was hosting, and I obviously didn't show up, and she was concerned about me. So when I got home, I called her and I told her everything that happened. And I ended with, I can't believe I didn't die. And her response was, it's not your time. And I was also still high from all the pills that I had taken, even though it was 3 days later. But as high as I was, her words were so profound that it actually sobered me up for a moment, because I was in this really like life feels really fragile when like that, you know, I was like in the aftermath of almost dying, and it just felt very fragile. So I was kind of in this crossroads, because part of me was like, I feel worse than I did before I took the pills. So maybe I just need to find another way to do it. But then once she said those words to me, it made me realize maybe I do have a purpose. And so in that moment is when I decided, I think I'm here for a reason and I want to figure out what that is. So I actually invested in myself and hired a coach, because traditional therapy had never worked for me. And obviously anything I had done up to that point was not working. So I was like, I want to get help, and I want to get help the right way. So it was actually my friend's words and her telling me that that made the big difference.
Yeah. I bet you are so grateful for your friend. And yeah. I'm sure that you don't ever let her forget that she saved your life in a way, that she helped you save your own life, really.
Yeah. And the funny thing about it was because I was so embarrassed about what happened. So when I called her, I was like, oh, I'm just going to like play it cool and pretend like nothing happened. But again, like I was like feeling so fragile and I was so emotional. So it was impossible to pretend like nothing happened. So yeah, it just actually ended up being divine timing that her workshop was that weekend and she was concerned that I didn't show up so that we ended up having that conversation.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I'm so glad that she was there for you.
Yes.
And that she could be that instrument for you where it helped you to be like, oh, I'm here for a reason and I am not living out my purpose at this point and I can find that.
Yeah, because it may seem obvious to someone listening like, oh yeah, if you defied the odds and survived, then you must be here for a reason. But that was not where my mind was at all, because like for the 2 weeks after I got out of the hospital, my only goal, because again, life felt very fragile, my only goal was to make it through the day. So trust me, I was not having any profound thoughts on my own. And I think I needed someone else to tell me that for me to actually have that realization.
Yeah, I think at least for me, I think many people are in that survival mode where they're, like you said, just trying to make it through the day. Was there anything during that time that really helped you get through the day?
Yes, because I hired my coach, and on our very first call, he asked me if you could do anything you wanted in your life and didn't have to worry about money or resources or anything else, what would you do? And at that point, my book, Running in Slippers, was just an idea that I had in my head because it's a memoir and it's really vulnerable. And the reason I wrote it that way is because we're not talking about the shitty things that happen to us in life. So I wanted to talk about it. But at that point in my life, I was terrified about allowing myself to be seen. And I was like, I could never, like, I wanted to write it, but I was like, I could never publish this because then other people would be reading about all these things that are going on in my life. And like, again, it's a total train wreck story. So I was embarrassed of people reading about it. But when he asked me that question, and again, like this is like within the time period that I'm speaking of where life felt fragile and my only goal is to make it through the day. So I'm joining this call, basically hanging on for dear life. And he asked me this question. And the first thing I thought about was my book. And I was like, oh yeah, I have this idea for a book. It's really vulnerable. And I want people to connect through vulnerability. So I want to go on a speaking tour all around the world. So there's safe places for people to be vulnerable. And I'm telling about him about all of this. And then I finish and he was like, did you realize how lit up you just got up about that? And I did, because again, I was like just trying to like make it through the conversation. And I noticed that how excited I was feeling and how lit up I was feeling. So even though my work with him was, you know, it's like you can't change, you know, because I was 40 at the time. So it's like I had spent 40 years living my life a certain way. So I wasn't going to change overnight. And I knew that was going to be a process. So in the meantime, I was like, maybe my purpose is this book. So the thing that really kept me going in those initial days was like being serious about writing my book and publishing it.
Yeah. And I, as you know, when we spoke previously, I got your book from Amazon as the ebook, but then I'm not an incredibly fast reader. So then I got the audiobook, and you read the audiobook. And
yes.
Well, you tell your own story very well on that book.
Thank you. Did you listen to the whole thing? Because I know you started. Okay.
Yeah, it's really good. And I think that if anyone feels like, particularly anyone who feels like they might be in a similar situation to where you were, where they feel like giving up and their life feels like shit and they have no reason to live. Hey, you're not the only one who feels that way. You can find a purpose.
And the audiobook, first of all, the book was hard to write because, first of all, there were two moments in the book that every time... Well, actually, my original point was when you write a book, you read it a gazillion times in the editing process. So some of my worst mistakes are in that book. So I had to keep rereading my mistakes, which was very cringy. But then there were two moments in the book that always made me cry. So those were like really hard to go back and edit. But then the audiobook was even worse because there's something about speaking your story out loud. There were so many parts where I would just break down and cry where I wasn't even expecting. So it was really hard to record the audiobook.
Yeah, I bet it was. But in speaking the things that you were, because it sounds like you're ashamed of those things, in speaking them, how did that experience impact you? Like, did you experience that sort of shame can't live when you speak it, or do you still feel pretty shameful?
No, I think ultimately it was good for me to get it out. But when I was recording the audiobook, I got really depressed because, again, it was just like bringing up all this stuff. I think the best way to put it is when I was speaking out loud, it was putting me way more in the story than the writing was. So a lot of these experiences, I was truly reliving it by speaking it. So I kind of went through this depression a few months after I finished recording, because imagine like reliving the worst experiences of your life. And so it kind of threw me into that. But I think it was good for me because I needed to finish grieving those experiences.
Yeah, I think that's very well put, because sometimes we don't really work through those emotions that we have connected to really difficult situations or experiences that we've had. And when you were having to reread them and make edits and then reading the book out loud to record it for the audio version, you really had to go back and just work through those time and time again. And it was an opportunity over and over and over again for you to say, look at me.
Yeah.
Angie, from back then, we can work through this. And you really had that opportunity to do that, and you took it on.
Yeah. And another cool part about it is like I had grown so much since the end of the book. So as I was going through it, it was just really cool to see, like, because in my brain, I would be thinking about how I would respond to those situations now, which was totally different to how I actually responded to them. So like, it was cool to see my growth in that aspect as well.
Yeah, I'm sure that no one feels that as much as you do. That experience of getting to a point in your life and then being able to turn around and go, man, I've come a long way. Because yes. Sometimes like the day after day after day, it doesn't feel like you're getting very far. But then at a certain point, you kind of turn around and go, wow, I've really come a long way.
Yeah.
And it's wild.
Yeah. And it's funny because reading the audiobook was so traumatic for me. And that was the end, like, because my book was already published and then I published my audiobook. So I haven't revisited any of the book. So I think it would be interesting for me to go back and read it or listen to it to see like how bigger that gap is even now.
Yeah. And sometimes when you're telling your stories, sometimes your exasperation comes out but I like that because it's real, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think it helped that I was like actually reliving the experiences. Yeah. So if I was like annoyed or exasperated or whatever, that would actually come out.
Yeah.
But I think the sadness and everything else did too.
Yes. Yes. And for me personally, I really appreciate that because you're connected with your story. And some people, they're not connected to the story, even if it's theirs when they read it. So I want to move on to your mask. You wear a people-pleasing mask, and now you coach women on breaking out of people-pleasing cycles. So what did people-pleasing look like in your life before everything shifted?
I don't even think that's a simple answer, but in short, what it looked like, I would basically mold myself into what either other people expected me to be or what I thought they expected me to be. And what that looked like in hindsight, or what that looks like in hindsight, is I basically had no identity of my own because I was constantly catering to what other people wanted and needed. And it's like, I didn't even stop to concern myself with like, how do I feel about this? Like, am I abandoning myself? Or none of those things even crossed my mind. So I basically had no identity and I was living my entire life for other people. And most of these people weren't respectful to me, or you know what I mean? So the energy was so unreciprocal.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's really tough. But why do you think so many of us cling to the masks that we wear, even when doing so suffocates us?
That's a great question, because when I did hire my coach and I started my healing journey in earnest, and I realized that I was way more happy and fulfilled not doing the things that I had been doing, and I would kind of kick myself sometimes, like, why was I doing that for so long? Because I was so miserable, it wasn't working. But the truth was, it's because I didn't know, because until I hired a coach, I didn't know what I was doing wrong or how to fix it. And and it's easy for me to describe this in hindsight, like I lost my identity and I cared more about what other people thought. But me back then, that was just my way of life. So for me to step out of my body and try to explain what was going on, like I thought that's who I was. So it's like, if it's the only thing you know, like how do you know anything different? And that's why it's hard, I think, a lot of times too, for women to actually get help for these situations, because it's like you can't even identify it to even know where to go. But one of the ways that you know, if like, for instance, for people pleasing, you generally feel very resentful and you also feel very exhausted because you're constantly giving outside of yourself and you're never filling your own cup. So there are signs that you can identify, even if you aren't self-aware enough to be like, oh, yes, I'm a people pleaser and I'm doing X, Y, Z. And I know I need to do A, B, C to fix it, but I don't know how, because I was not at that level of self-awareness.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because as you're speaking, I'm thinking and I'm thinking about when I went to college out of high school, and this is what you're saying is bringing up in my mind. When I first went to college, I felt like I turned into a different person, which I'm sure a lot of people, when they go to a college initially away from home, they sort of turn into a butterfly and spread their wings. Well, I didn't know that I really liked talking to people. I'm an introvert naturally, and so in a large crowd, I'm going to be quieter, but I really enjoy talking with and getting to know people and building relationships. And I learned that about myself, and I thought, why don't I do that at home? Why didn't I do that before? But in hindsight, I think that as a child and an adolescent, I was always trying to make sure that my parents, particularly my mother, shouldn't have to do anything extra for me, because my brother, when he was in high school, and I think maybe even the latter part of junior high, he used to get in fights in school a lot. And so my mom might have to go to the school frequently for my brother. So then I learned, like, boy, that really stresses my mom out and I don't want to do that. So I don't recall feeling like I need to make sure that she's happy with me. I just could see that she was stressed out and I didn't want to give her more stress.
Yeah.
So it's interesting because now I see this from a different perspective, that when I left home to go to college, I didn't have to wear that mask. I didn't have to make sure somebody wasn't upset or stressed out more because of me. I got to be me and just do what I enjoyed and figured that out.
Yeah. So it's interesting because I still don't feel like I had that experience in college. Like I was a little more free, but because I had been conditioned to people please for so long, I just kept doing it.
Yeah. So I'm going to have one of my friends on. We're going to talk about the Enneagram. And I can't recall if in our previous conversations we've talked about the Enneagram, but I'm an eight, and eights are, they have a lot of big energy where they kind of don't really care what you think.
Wait, so, what is that?
The Enneagram. So it's the best way that I know how to describe it is a personality sort of thing. And it's a numbers 1 to 9, and I'm an eight. And we usually kind of just don't care what you think kind of thing.
See, I'm that way now, but I wasn't before, obviously.
Yeah. Also, one thing that I've learned about myself is that my brain works like a solution ATM. So I think I put some of my friends off, and definitely my husband and my mother, because when I hear a problem, my brain just starts working on solutions. And they aren't all great solutions or even viable, but it still turns out solutions, like options.
And some people just want to vent.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's really interesting. So I'm super excited to talk to her about this this topic. So with her, we're going to talk about like how we cope, the different numbers, different types cope. And so I'm excited to learn more about that. But I didn't mean to derail us.
Oh, that's okay. I learned something new.
Yeah, I like to learn.
I want to look up what my number is now.
I'll send you a link for the test that she shared with me.
Okay.
Okay. So I want to move on to your radical self-love and allowing yourself to be seen, which can be so, so difficult for many of us. Your story is about choosing authenticity over performance.
Yes.
So what did radical self-love look like for you in practice? Not the Instagram version, but the messy real one.
Well, I think the biggest step that I took, but not the only step, was publishing my book, because it is vulnerable. And I spiraled into an anxiety attack the day it was published, because I was like, oh my God. All people I don't even know are going to be reading about this. And also, keep in mind, because I was high functioning, most people that I knew didn't even know about half the stuff that I wrote about. So that was also very terrifying. But what I learned was, because other people go through shitty things too, everyone who reached out to me about the book, and I'm not even talking about just people that I know, but complete strangers have reached out to me and said, this exact same thing has happened to me too. And it was wild to me how many shared, it may be not everyone was like, this is the exact same thing, although several people did, but it's like, it's just amazing like how many shared experiences we have as human beings. And it actually made me feel not so alone. So I'm sure it made the readers feel that way too. So that was like my first big step in allowing myself to be seen, because again, like my worst mistakes, like the worst period of my life was all out there for people to see. But that being said, even though now I have an understanding that vulnerability works the opposite way that we think it does, and it actually is very connecting, it's still extremely hard to do. For example, like when I post on Instagram, I try to be authentic, but at the same time, I'm promoting my business. So it's like I feel like I tend to scrutinize things or how I say things. And I don't know, I still go through the whole, I criticize myself when I do allow myself to be seen. So I do still struggle with that. It is a lot better though.
Good. So do you think that that is the hardest part about allowing yourself to be seen, just that whole sharing yourself on social media and such, where you're promoting your business. And so you feel like maybe you need to put a particular face forward, or is it more than that?
Well, I guess there's two sides to it. So it's definitely deeper than that, because I grew up in a very critical home. So I felt like I was always under the microscope. And I'm talking about even for my appearance, which is hard to hide sometimes, because it's like unless I'm wearing a true mask or like a costume, like my appearance is out in the open. So my allowing myself to be seen wound started in my childhood, because I just wanted to hide and didn't even want anyone to look at me. So there is that aspect of it, because if I allow myself to be seen, I'm afraid that I'm going to be criticized. But then there is, because as you know, I came from corporate America, where to some extent you do have to wear a professional mask. And I still have some of that conditioning when I'm promoting my business on Instagram. However, I'm actively trying to overcome that. So for example, I struggle with video content because I get really anxious. It doesn't, in my opinion, it doesn't feel natural. Like, this is a conversation, this feels natural to me. But if I just set up my camera and film, then I don't know, it just feels awkward. And I feel like I come off as awkward. But I notice that if I film myself when I'm walking, that lessens my anxiety. But the only time I'm walking is when I'm coming to and from surfing, and I'm wearing like I wear like that pasty zinc sunscreen, and like I always put conditioner in my hair, and you know, so it's like I'm not looking cute by any means. But then I was like, this would be funny. I call it a walk and talk series. So I started filming myself like to and from surfing, doing my video content as I am. And I'm like, this is how I'm going to show up, because it's not perfect. And that's kind of my brand, right? So I started doing more imperfect videos.
But I love that. And I think people identify with the imperfection, because again, that's something we don't talk about, how really humans are imperfect. Do we know that? Sure. On a surface level, we know we're not perfect because we're human, but the expectations that so many people are under, so many of us are held to this higher standard, whether it's by self or someone else because of the environment they grew up in, or the job that they have, it's really difficult to be like, you know what? I'm not perfect, and I'm going to own that. And if you don't like it, sorry, not sorry, kind of thing. Yeah. But it can be particularly difficult, I think, for young people when they still live at home with their parents. If that's when they are held to the impossibly high standards. Also, when it comes to your job, if there are impossibly high standards, that can be really tricky too, right? Because you have to be able to pay your bills, right? And being human doesn't necessarily pay your bills. I mean,
that's ultimately why I left corporate America, because it was just, there was so much of a disconnect between that world and who I really am. And I mentally and physically could not take it anymore.
Yeah, it can be particularly difficult. That's a wrap on part one of my conversation with Angie Hawkins, who showed up with so much honesty about people-pleasing, self-abandonment, and the slow, courageous work of turning towards radical self-love. If this conversation hit home, remember, you are not broken and you're not alone. If you or someone you love is struggling, you can call or text 988 in the U.S. for the Suicide and Crisis Lifeline. Next week in part two with Angie, we'll cover how to shift from external validation to internal confidence using her Shine from the Inside framework, smart, doable boundary scripts, and why enforcing them is the real muscle, the 90-second anxiety reset you can use tonight, reframing fear into excitement. Think Carly versus Bruce, you'll see. And why being seen on your own terms matters more than polished perfection. Until then, if you're a high-functioning human who's tired of pretending everything is fine, share this episode with a friend who needs it and leave a quick rating or review. It helps more people find these conversations. You can also connect with Angie and her book, Running in Slippers, plus her coaching program, Shine from the Inside, at runninginslippers.com. And you can always find me on Instagram. Links are in the show notes. I'm Sasha Holder, and this is The High Functioning Disaster, where we tell the truth about messy, beautiful, real life. I'll see you next time. Oh, and one last thing. The content shared on The High Functioning Disaster is for informational and conversational purposes only and is not intended as professional, medical, or mental health advice. Everyone's situation is unique, and what we talk about here may not apply to your specific circumstances. Please do what's right for you and always consult with a qualified professional for medical, mental health, financial, or legal guidance. You take care of you, boo. See you next time.